Cash is looking at him. "We'll get it over," he says. "I tell you what you do. You ride on back and walk across the bridge and come down the other bank and meet us with the rope. Vernon'll take your horse home with him and keep it till we get back."
"You go to hell,"
Jewel says. "You take the rope and come down the bank and be ready with it," Cash says. "Three can't do no more than two can, one to drive and one to steady it."
"God damn you," Jewel says.
"Let Jewel take the end of the rope and cross upstream of us and brace it," I say. "Will you do that, Jewel?" Jewel watches me, hard. He looks quick at Cash, then back at me, his eyes alert and hard.
"I don't give a damn. Just so we do something. Sitting here not lifting a goddamn hand."
"Let's do that, Cash," I say.
"I reckon we'll have to," Cash says.
The river itself is not 100 yards across, and Pa and Vernon and Vardaman and Dewey Dell are the only things in sight not of that single monotony of desolation leaning with that terrific quality a little from right to left, as though we had reached the place where the motion of the wasted world accelerates just before the final precipice. Yet they appear dwarfed. It is as though the space between us were time, an irrevocable quality. It is as though time, no longer running straight before us in a diminishing line, now runs parallel between us like a looping string, the distance being the doubling accretion of the thread, and not the interval between. The mules stand, their forequarters already sloped a little, their rumps high. They too are breathing now with a deep groaning sound. Looking back once, their gaze sweeps across us, with in their eyes a wild, sad, profound, and despairing quality, as though they had already seen in the thick water the shape of the disaster which they could not speak and we could not see. Cash turns back into the wagon. He lays his hands flat on Addie, rocking her a little. His face is calm, downsloped, calculant, concerned. He lifts his box of tools and wedges it forward under the seat. Together we shove Addie forward, wedging her between the tools and the wagon bed. Then he looks at me. "No," I say. "I reckon I'll stay. Might take both of us." From the toolbox he takes his coiled rope and carries the end twice around the seat stanchion and passes the end to me without tying it. The other end he pays out to Jewel, who takes a turn about his saddle horn. He must force the horse down into the current. It moves, high-kneed, arch-necked, boring and chafing. Jewel sits lightly forward, his knees lifted a little. Again, his swift, alert, calm gaze sweeps upon us and on. He lowers the horse into the stream, speaking to it in a soothing murmur. The horse slips, goes under to the saddle, surges to its feet again, the current building up against Jewel's thighs.
"Watch yourself," Cash says. "I'm on it now," Jewel says. "You can come ahead now."
Cash takes the reins and lowers the team carefully and skillfully into the stream. I felt the current take us, and I knew we were on the ford by that reason, since it was only by means of that slipping contact that we could tell that we were in motion at all. What had once been a flat surface was now a succession of troughs and hillocks lifting and falling about us, shoving at us, teasing at us with light, lazy touches in the vain instants of solidity underfoot. Cash looked back at me, and then I knew that we were gone. But I did not realize the reason for the rope until I saw the log. It surged up out of the water and stood for an instant upright upon that surging and heaving desolation, like Christ. "Get out and let the current take you down to the bend," Cash said. "You can make it all right." "No," I said. "I'd get just as wet that way as this." The log appears suddenly between two hills, as if it had rocketed suddenly from the bottom of the river. Upon the end of it, A long gout of foam hangs like the beard of an old man or a goat. When Cash speaks to me, I know that he has been watching it all the time, watching it and watching Jewel 10 feet ahead of us. "Let the rope go," he says. With his other hand, he reaches down and reeves the 2 turns from the stanchion. "Ride on, Jewel," he says. "See if you can pull us ahead of the log." Jewel shouts at the horse. Again, he appears to lift it bodily between his knees. He is just above the top of the ford, and the horse has a purchase of some sort, for it surges forward, shining wetly half out of water, crashing on in a succession of lunges. It moves unbelievably fast. By that token, Jewel realizes at last that the rope is free, for I can see him sawing back on the reins, his head turned, as the log rears in a long, sluggish lunge between us, bearing down upon the team. They see it too. For a moment, they also shine black out of water. Then the downstream one vanishes, dragging the other with him. The wagon shears crosswise, poised on the crest of the ford as the log strikes it, tilting it up and on. Cash is half-turned, the reins running taut from his hand and disappearing into the water, the other hand reached back upon Addie, holding her jammed over against the high side of the wagon. "Jump clear," he says quietly. "Stay away from the team and don't try to fight it. It'll swing you into the bend all right." "You come too," I say. Vernon and Vardaman are running along the bank. Pa and Dewey Dell stand watching us. Dewey Dell with the basket and the package in her arms. Jewel is trying to fight the horse back. The head of one mule appears, its eyes wide. It looks back at us for an instant, making a sound almost human. The head vanishes again. "Back, Jewel!" Cash shouts. "Back, Jewel!" For another instant, I see him leaning to the tilting wagon, his arm braced back against Addie and his tools. I see the bearded head of the rearing log strike up again, and beyond it Jewel holding the horse upreared, its head wrenched around, hammering its head with his fist. I jump from the wagon on the downstream side. Between 2 hills, I see the mules once more. They roll up out of the water in succession, turning completely over, their legs stiffly extended, as when they had lost contact with the earth.
Vardaman. Cash tried, but she fell off, and Dar jumped going under. He went under, and Cash hollering to catch her, and I hollering, running, and hollering, and Dewey Dell hollering at me, "Vardaman, you, Vardaman, you, Vardaman," and Vernon passed me because he was seeing her come up, and she jumped into the water again, and Dahl hadn't caught her yet. He came up to see, and I hollering, "Catch her, Dahl, catch her," and he didn't come back because she was too heavy. He had to go on catching at her, and I hollering, "Catch her, Dahl, catch her, Dahl," because in the water she could go faster than a man, and Dahl had to grapple for her, so I knew he could catch her because he is the best grabbler, even with the mules in the way. Again, they dived up, rolling their feet stiff, rolling down again, and their backs up now. And Dahl had to again because in the water she could go faster than a man or a woman. And I passed Vernon, and he wouldn't get in the water and help Dahl. He wouldn't grabble for her with Dahl. He knew, but he wouldn't help. The mules dived up again, diving their legs stiff, their stiff legs rolling slow, and then Dahl again, and I hollering, "Catch her, Dahl, catch her, head her into the bank, Dahl," and Vernon wouldn't help, and then Dahl dodged past the mules where he could. He had her under the water, coming into the bank, coming in slow, because in the water she fought to stay under the water. But Dahl is strong, and he was coming in slow, and so I knew he had her because he came slow, and I ran down into the water to help. And I couldn't stop hollering because Dahl was strong and steady, holding her under the water, Even if she did fight, he would not let her go. He was seeing me, and he would hold her, and it was all right now. It was all right now. It was all right. Then he comes up out of the water. He comes a long way up slow before his hands do, but he's got to have her, got to, so I can bear it. Then his hands come up, and all of him above the water. I can't stop. I have not got time to try. I will try to when I can, but his hands came empty out of the water, emptying away. "Where is Ma, Darl?" I said. "You never got her. You knew she is a fish, but you let her get away. You never got her. Darl. Darl. Darl." I began to run along the bank, watching the mules dive up slow again and then down again. Tull. When I told Cora how Darl jumped out of the wagon and left Cash sitting there trying to save it, and the wagon turning over, and Jewel that was almost to the bank fighting that horse back where it had more sense than to go, she says, "And you're one of the folks that says Darl is the queer one, the one that ain't bright, and him the only one of them that had sense enough to get off that wagon." I noticed Ants was too smart to been on it at all. "He couldn't have done no good if he had been there," I said. "They was going about it right, and they would have made it if it hadn't have been for that log." "Log fiddlesticks," Cora said. "It was the hand of God." "Then how can you say it was foolish?" I said. "Nobody can't guard against the hand of God. It would be sacrilege to try to." "Then why dare it?" Cora says. "Tell me that." "Ants didn't," I said. "That's just what you faulted him for." "His place was there," Cora said. "If he had been a man, he would have been there instead of making his sons do what he dursn't." "I don't know what you want then," I said. "One breath you say they was there in the hand of God to try it, and the next breath you jump on Ants because he wasn't with them." Then she began to sing again, working at the washtub, with that singing look in her face like she had done give up folks and all their foolishness, and had done went on ahead of them, marching up the sky, singing. The wagon hung for a long time while the current built up under it, shoving it off the ford, and Cash leaning more and more, trying to keep the coffin braced so it wouldn't slip down and finish tilting the wagon over. Soon as the wagon got tilted good, to where the current could finish it, the log went on. It headed around the wagon and went on good as a swimming man could have done. It was like it had been sent there to do a job and done it, and went on. When the mules finally kicked loose, it looked for a minute like maybe Cash would get the wagon back. It looked like him and the wagon wasn't moving at all, and just Jewel fighting that horse back to the wagon. Then that boy passed me, running and hollering at Darl, and the gal trying to catch him. And then I see the mules come rolling slow up out of the water, their legs spraddled stiff like they had balked upside down, and roll on into the water again. Then the wagon tilted over, and then it and Jewel and the horse was all mixed up together. Cash went out in sight, still holding the coffin braced. And then I couldn't tell anything for the horse lunging and splashing. I thought that Cash had give up then and was swimming for it. And I was yelling at Jewel to come on back. And then, all of a sudden, him and the horse went under too, and I thought they was all going. I knew that the horse had got dragged off the ford, too. And with that wild, drowning horse and that wagon and that loose box, it was going to be pretty bad. And there I was, standing knee-deep in the water, yelling at ants behind me, "See what you done now? See what you done now?" The horse come up again. It was headed for the bank now, throwing its head up. And then I saw one of them holding to the saddle on the downstream side. So I started running along the bank, trying to catch sight of Cash because he couldn't swim, yelling at Jewel where Cash was, like a darn fool, bad as that boy that was on down the bank still hollering at Darl. So I went down into the water so I could still keep some kind of a grip in the mud when I saw Jewel. He was middle deep, so I knew he was on the ford anyway, leaning hard upstream. And then I see the rope, and then I see the water building up where he was holding the wagon and snubbed just below the ford. So it was Cash holding to the horse when it comes splashing and scrambling up the bank, moaning and groaning like a natural man. When I come to it, it was just kicking Cash loose from his holt on the saddle. His face turned up a second when he was sliding back into the water. It was gray, with his eyes closed and a long swipe of mud across his face. Then he let go and turned over in the water. He looked just like a old bundle of clothes kind of washing up and down against the bank. He looked like he was laying there in the water on his face, rocking up and down a little, looking at something on the bottom. We could watch the rope cutting down into the water, and we could feel the weight of the wagon kind of blump and lunge lazy-like, like it just as soon as not, and that rope cutting down into the water hard as an iron bar. We could hear the water hissing on it like it was red hot, like it was a straight iron bar stuck into the bottom and us holding the end of it. And the wagon lazing up and down, kind of pushing and prodding at us, like it had come around and got behind us, lazy-like, like it just as soon as not when it made up its mind. There was a shote come by, blowed up like a balloon, one of them spotted shotes of Long Quick's. It bumped against the rope like it was an iron bar and bumped off and went on. And us watching that rope slanting down into the water. We watched it.
Darl. Cash lies on his back on the earth, his head raised on a rolled garment. His eyes are closed, his face is gray, his hair plastered in a smooth smear across his forehead, as though done with a paintbrush. His face appears sunken a little, sagging from the bony ridges of eye sockets, nose, gums, as though the wetting had slacked the firmness which had held the skin full. His teeth, set in pale gums, are parted a little, as if he had been laughing quietly. He lies pole-thin in his wet clothes, a little pool of vomit at his head, and a thread of it running from the corner of his mouth and down his cheek, where he couldn't turn his head quick or far enough, until Dewey Dell stoops and wipes it away with the hem of her dress. Jewel approaches. He has the plane. "Vernon just found the square," he says. He looks down at Cash, dripping too. "Ain't he talked none yet?" "He had his saw and hammer and chalk line and rule," I say. "I know that." Jewel lays the square down. Pa watches him. "They can't be far away," Pa says. "It all went together. Was there e'er a such misfortunate man?" Jewel does not look at Pa. "You better call Vardaman back here," he says. He looks at Cash. Then he turns and goes away. "Get him to talk as soon as he can," he says, "so he can tell us what else there was." We return to the river. The wagon is hauled clear, the wheels chocked, carefully. We all helped. It is as though upon the shabby, familiar, inert shape of the wagon There lingered somehow, latent yet still immediate, that violence which had slain the mules that drew it not an hour since, above the edge of the flood. In the wagon bed it lies profoundly, the long, pale planks hushed a little with wetting, yet still yellow, like gold seen through water, save for two long, muddy smears. We pass it and go on to the bank. One end of the rope is made fast to a tree. At the edge of the stream, knee-deep, Vardaman stands, bent forward a little, watching Vernon with rapt absorption. He has stopped yelling, and he is wet to the armpits. Vernon is at the other end of the rope, shoulder deep in the river, looking back at Vardaman. "Further back than that," he says. "You get back by the tree and hold the rope for me, so it can't slip." Vardaman backs along the rope to the tree, moving blindly, watching Vernon. When we come up, he looks at us once, his eyes round and a little dazed. Then he looks at Vernon again, in that posture of rapt alertness. "I got the hammer, too," Vernon says. "Looks like we ought to done already got that chalk line. It ought to floated." "Floated clean away," Jules says. "We won't get it. We ought to find the saw, though." "I reckon so," Vernon says. He looks at the water. "That chalk line, too. What else did he have?" "He ain't talked yet," Jules says, entering the water. He looks back at me. "You go back and get him roused up to talk," he says. "Pause there," I say. I follow Jules into the water, along the rope. It feels alive in my hand, bellied faintly in a prolonged and resonant arc. Vernon is watching me. "You better go," he says. "You better be there." "Let's see what else we can get before it washes on down," I say. We hold to the rope, the current curling and dimpling about our shoulders. But beneath that false blandness, the true force of it leans against us lazily. I had not thought that water in July could be so cold. It is like hands molding and prodding at the very bones. Vernon is still looking back toward the bank. "Reckon it'll hold us all?" he says. We too look back, following the rigid bar of the rope as it rises from the water to the tree, and Vardaman crouched a little beside it, watching us. "Wish my mule wouldn't strike out for home," Vernon says. "Come on," Jules says. "Let's get out in here." We submerge in turn, holding to the rope, being clutched by one another while the cold wall of the water sucks the slanting mud backward and upstream from beneath our feet, and we are suspended so, groping along the cold bottom. Even the mud there is not still. It has a chill, scouring quality, as though the earth under us were in motion, too. We touch and fumble at one another's extended arms, letting ourselves go cautiously against the rope, or, erect in turn, watch the water suck and boil where one of the other two gropes beneath the surface. Paws come down to the shore, watching us. Vernon comes up, streaming, his face sloped down into his pursed, blowing mouth. His mouth is bluish, like a circle of weathered rubber. He has the rule. "He'll be glad of that," I say. "It's right new. He bought it just last month out of the catalog." "If we just knowed for sure what else," Vernon says, looking over his shoulder and then turning to face where Jewel had disappeared. "Didn't he go down for me?" Vernon says. "I don't know," I say. "I think so. Yes. Yes, he did." We watch the thick, curling surface streaming away from us in slow whirls. "Give him a pull on the rope," Vernon says. "He's on your end of it," I say. "Ain't nobody on my end of it," he says. "Pull it in," I say. But he has already done that, holding the end above the water. And then we see Jewel. He is 10 yards away. He comes up, blowing, and looks at us, tossing his long hair back with a jerk of his head. Then he looks toward the bank. We can see him filling his lungs. "Jewel?" Vernon says, not loud, but his voice going full and clear along the water, peremptory yet tactful. "It'll be back here. Better come back." Jewel dives again. We stand there, leaning back against the current, watching the water where he disappeared, holding the dead rope between us like two men holding the nozzle of a fire hose, waiting for the water. Suddenly, Dewey Dell is behind us in the water.
"You make him come back," she says. "Jewel," she says.
He comes up again, tossing his hair back from his eyes. He is swimming now toward the bank, the current sweeping him downstream, quartering.
"You, Jewel,"
Dewey Dell says. We stand holding the rope and see him gain the bank and climb out. As he rises from the water, he stoops and picks up something. He comes back along the bank. He has found the chalk line. He comes opposite us and stands there, looking about as if he were seeking something. Pa goes on down the bank. He is going back to look at the mules again, where their round bodies float and rub quietly together in the slack water within the bend.
"What did you do with the hammer, Vernon?"
Jewel says.
"I give it to him,"
Vernon says, jerking his head at Vardaman. Vardaman is looking after Pa. Then he looks at Jewel.
"With the square."
Vernon is watching Jewel. He moves toward the bank, passing Dewey Dell and me.
"You get on out of here," I say.
She says nothing, looking at Jewel and Vernon.
"Where's the hammer?"
Jewel says. Vardaman scuttles up the bank and fetches it.
"It's heavier than the saw,"
Vernon says. Jewel is tying the end of the chalk line about the hammer shaft.
"Hammer's got the most wood in it,"
Jewel says. He and Vernon face one another, watching Jewel's hands.
"And flatter, too," Vernon says. "It'd float 3-1 almost. Try the plane."
Jewel looks at Vernon. Vernon is tall, too, long and lean, eye to eye. They stand in their close, wet clothes. Lon Quick could look even at a cloudy sky and tell the time to 10 minutes. Big Lon, I mean, not little Lon.
"Why don't you get out of the water?"
I say.
"It won't float like a saw,"
Jewel says.
"It'll float nigher to a saw than a hammer will,"
Vernon says.
"Betcha,"
Jewel says.
"I won't bet,"
Vernon says. They stand there, watching Jewel's still hands.
"Hell," Jewel says. "Get the plane, then."
So they get the plane and tie it to the chalk line and enter the water again. Pa comes back along the bank. He stops for a while and looks at us, hunched, mournful, like a failing steer or an old tall bird. Vernon and Jewel return, leaning against the current.
"Get out of the way," Jewel says to Dewey Dell. "Get out of the water."
She crowds against me a little so they can pass, Jewel holding the plane high as though it were perishable, the blue string trailing back over his shoulder. They pass us and stop. They fall to arguing quietly about just where the wagon went over.
"Darl ought to know," Vernon says.
They look at me.
"I don't know,"
I says.
"I wasn't there that long." "Hell,"
Jewel says. They move on gingerly, leaning against the current, reading the ford with their feet.
"Have you got a hold to the rope?"
Vernon says. Jewel does not answer. He glances back at the shore, calculant, then at the water. He flings the plane outward, letting the string run through his fingers turning blue where it runs over them. When the line stops, he hands it back to Vernon.
"Better let me go this time,"
Vernon says. Again, Jewel does not answer. We watch him duck beneath the surface.
"Jewel,"
Dewey Dell whimpers.
"It ain't so deep there,"
Vernon says. He does not look back. He is watching the water where Jewel went under. When Jewel comes up, He has the saw. When we pass the wagon, Pa is standing beside it, scrubbing at the two mud smears with a handful of leaves. Against the jungle, Jewel's horse looks like a patchwork quilt hung on a line. Cash is not moved. We stand above him, holding the plane, the saw, the hammer, the square, the rule, the chalk line, while Dewey Dell squats and lifts Cash's head.
Cash, she says. Cash.
He opens his eyes, staring profoundly up at our inverted faces.
If ever was such a misfortunate man, Pa says.
Look, Cash, we say, holding the tools up so he can see. What else did you have? He tries to speak, rolling his head, shutting his eyes. Cash, we say. Cash. It is to vomit he is turning his head. Dewey Dell wipes his mouth on the wet hem of her dress. Then he can speak. It's his saw set, Jewel says. The new one he bought when he bought the rule. He moves, turning away. Vernon looks up after him, still squatting. Then he rises and follows Jewel down to the water.
If ever was such a misfortunate man, Pa says.
He looms tall above us as we squat. He looks like a figure carved clumsily from tough wood by a drunken caricaturist.
It's a trial, he says, but I don't begrudge her it. No man can say I begrudge her it.
Dewey Dell has laid Cash's head back on the folded coat, twisting his head a little to avoid the vomit. Beside him his tools lie.
A fellow might call it lucky it was the same leg he broke when he fell off in that church, Pa says. But I don't begrudge her it.
Jewel and Vernon are in the river again. From here they do not appear to violate the surface at all. It is as though it had severed them both in a single blow, the two torsos moving with infinitesimal and ludicrous care upon the surface. It looks peaceful, like machinery does after you have watched it and listened to it for a long time. As though the clotting which is you had dissolved into the myriad original motion, and seeing and hearing in themselves blind and deaf, fury in itself, quiet with stagnation. Squatting, Dewey Dell's wet dress shapes for the dead eyes of three blind men those mammalian ludicrosities which are the horizons and the valleys of the earth.
Cash. It wasn't on a balance. I told them that if they wanted it to tote and ride on a balance, they would have to...
Cora. One day we were talking. She had never been pure religious, not even after that summer at the camp meeting, when Brother Whitfield wrestled with her spirit, singled her out and strove with the vanity in her mortal heart. And I said to her many a time, God gave you children to comfort your hard human lot, and for a token of his own suffering and love, for in love you conceived and bore them. I said that because she took God's love and her duty to him too much as a matter of course, and such conduct is not pleasing to him. I said, he gave us the gift to raise our voices in his undying praise, because I said there is more rejoicing in heaven over one sinner than over 100 that never sinned. And she said, my daily life is an acknowledgement and expiation of my sin. And I said, who are you to say what is sin and what is not sin? It is the Lord's part to judge, ours to praise his mercy and his holy name in the hearing of our fellow mortals, because he alone can see into the heart. And just because a woman's life is right in the sight of man, she can't know if there is no sin in her heart without she opens her heart to the Lord and receives his grace. I said, just because you have been a faithful wife is no sign that there is no sin in your heart. And just because your life is hard is no sign that the Lord's grace is absolving you. And she said, I know my own sin. I know that I deserve my punishment. I do not begrudge it. And I said, It is out of your vanity that you would judge sin and salvation in the Lord's place. It is our mortal lot to suffer and to raise our voices in praise of Him who judges the sin and offers the salvation through our trials and tribulations, time out of mind. Amen. Not even after Brother Whitfield, a godly man, if ever one breathed God's breath, prayed for you and strove as never a man could except him, I said. Because it is not us that can judge our sins or know what is sin in the Lord's eyes. She has had a hard life, but so does every woman. But you'd think from the way she talked that she knew more about sin and salvation than the Lord God Himself, than them who have strove and labored with the sin in this human world. When the only sin she ever committed was being partial to Jewel, that never loved her and was its own punishment, in preference to Darl that was touched by God Himself and considered queer by us mortals and that did love her. I said, There is your sin, and your punishment too. Jewel is your punishment. But where is your salvation? And life is short enough, I said, to win eternal grace in. And God is a jealous God. It is His to judge and to meet, not yours. I know, she said. Then she stopped, and I said, Know what? Nothing, she said. He is my cross, and He will be my salvation. He will save me from the water and from the fire, even though I have laid down my life. He will save me. How do you know without you open your heart to Him and lift your voice in His praise? I said. Then I realized that she did not mean God. I realized that out of the vanity of her heart she had spoken sacrilege, and I went down on my knees right there. I begged her to kneel and open her heart and cast from it the devil of vanity and cast herself upon the mercy of the Lord. But she wouldn't. She just sat there, lost in her vanity and her pride that had closed her heart to God and set that selfish mortal boy in his place. Kneeling there, I prayed for her. I prayed for that poor, blind woman as I had never prayed for me and mine.
Addie. In the afternoon, when school was out and the last one had left with his little dirty, snuffling nose, instead of going home, I would go down the hill to the spring where I could be quiet and hate them. It would be quiet there then, with the water bubbling up and away and the sun slanting quiet in the trees and the quiet smelling of damp and rotting leaves and new earth, especially in the early spring. For it was worse then. I could just remember how my father used to say that the reason for living was to get ready to stay dead a long time. And when I would have to look at them day after day, each with his and her secret and selfish thought, and blood strange to each other blood and strange to mine, and think that this seemed to be the only way I could get ready to stay dead, I would hate my father for having ever planted me. I would look forward to the times when they faltered so I could whip them. When the switch fell, I could feel it upon my flesh. When it welted and ridged, it was my blood that ran. And I would think with each blow of the switch, now you are aware of me. Now I am something in your secret and selfish life who have marked your blood with my own forever and ever. And so I took Anse. I saw him pass the schoolhouse 3 or 4 times before I learned that he was driving 4 miles out of his way to do it. I noticed then how he was beginning to hump, a tall man and young, so that he looked already like a tall bird hunched in the cold weather on the wagon seat. He would pass the schoolhouse, the wagon creaking slow, his head turning slow to watch the door of the schoolhouse as the wagon passed, until he went on around the curve and out of sight. One day I went to the door and stood there when he passed. When he saw me, he looked quickly away and did not look back again. In the early spring, it was worst. Sometimes I thought that I could not bear it, lying in bed at night with the wild geese going north and their honking coming faint and high and wild out of the wild darkness. And during the day it would seem as though I couldn't wait for the last one to go so I could go down to the spring. And so when I looked up that day and saw Ant standing there in his Sunday clothes, turning his hat round and round in his hands, I said, "If you've got any women folks, why in the world don't they make you get your hair cut?" "I ain't got none," he said. Then he said suddenly, driving his eyes at me like two hounds in a strange yard, "That's what I come to see you about." "And make you hold your shoulders up," I said. "You haven't got any?" "But you've got a house. They tell me you've got a house and a good farm. And you live there alone, doing for yourself, do you?" He just looked at me, turning the hat in his hands. "A new house," I said. "Are you going to get married?" And he said again, holding his eyes to mine, "That's what I come to see you about." Later, he told me, "I ain't got no people, so that won't be no worry to you. I don't reckon you can say the same." "No, I have people. In Jefferson." His face fell a little. "Well, I got a little property. I'm four-handed. I got a good, honest name. I know how town folks are, but maybe when they talk to me..." "They might listen," I said, "but they'll be hard to talk to." He was watching my face. "They're in the cemetery." "But your living kin," he said, "they'll be different." "Will they?" I said. "I don't know. I never had any other kind." So I took Ants, and when I knew that I had cash, I knew that living was terrible and that this was the answer to it. That was when I learned that words are no good, that words don't ever fit even what they are trying to say at. When he was born, I knew that motherhood was invented by someone who had to have a word for it, because the ones that had the children didn't care whether there was a word for it or not. I knew that fear was invented by someone that had never had the fear, pride, who never had the pride. I knew that it had been not that they had dirty noses, but that we had had to use one another by words, like spiders dangling by their mouths from a beam, swinging and twisting and never touching, and that only through the blows of the switch could my blood and their blood flow as one stream. I knew that it had been not that my aloneness had to be violated over and over each day, but that it had never been violated until Cash came. Not even by Ants in the nights. He had a word, too. Love, he called it. But I had been used to words for a long time. I knew that that word was like the others, just a shape to fill a lack. That when the right time came, you wouldn't need a word for that any more than for pride or fear. Cash did not need to say it to me, nor I to him. And I would say, "Let Ants use it if he wants to." So that it was Ants or love, love or Ants, it didn't matter. I would think that even while I lay with him in the dark and Cash asleep in the cradle within the swing of my hand, I would think that if he were to wake and cry, I would suckle him, too. Ants or love, it didn't matter. My aloneness had been violated and then made whole again by the violation. Time, ants, love, what you will, outside the circle. Then I found that I had Darl. At first, I would not believe it. Then I believed that I would kill Ants. It was as though he had tricked me, hidden within a word like within a paper screen, and struck me in the back through it. But then I realized that I had been tricked by words older than Ants or love, and that the same word had tricked Ants, too. And that my revenge would be that he would never know I was taking revenge. And when Darl was born, I asked Ants to promise to take me back to Jefferson when I died, because I knew that Father had been right, even when he couldn't have known he was right, any more than I could have known I was wrong. Nonsense, Ants said. You and me ain't nigh done chapping yet with just two. He did not know that he was dead then. Sometimes I would lie by him in the dark, here in the land that was now of my blood and flesh, and I would think, Ants, why ants? Why are you ants? I would think about his name until after a while I could see the word as a shape, a vessel. And I would watch him liquefy and flow into it like cold molasses flowing out of the darkness into the vessel until the jar stood full and motionless. A significant shape profoundly without life, like an empty door frame. And then I would find that I had forgotten the name of the jar. I would think, the shape of my body where I used to be a virgin is in the shape of a... And I couldn't think ants, couldn't remember ants. It was not that I could think of myself as no longer unvirgin, because I was three now. And when I would think Cash and Darl that way until their names would die and solidify into a shape and then fade away, I would say, all right. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what they call them. And so when Cora Tull would tell me I was not a true mother, I would think how words go straight up in a thin line, quick and harmless, and how terribly doing goes along the earth, clinging to it, so that after a while the two lines are too far apart for the same person to straddle from one to the other. And that sin and love and fear are just sounds that people who never sinned nor loved nor feared have for what they never had and cannot have until they forget the words. Like Cora, who could never even cook. She would tell me what I owed to my children and to Ants and to God. I gave Ants the children. I did not ask for them. I did not even ask him for what he could have given me. Not Ants. That was my duty to him, to not ask that. And that duty I fulfilled. I would be I. I would let him be the shape and echo of his word. That was more than he asked, because he could not have asked for that and been Ants, using himself so with a word.
End of Disc 4.